I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There is drama today on Capitol Hill as the 111th Congress takes its oath of office. Senate officials turned away Roland Burris, who was appointed by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich to fill Barack Obama's Senate seat. Senate Democrats remain determined to keep Burris out after he was picked by Blagojevich, who was accused of trying to sell the Senate seat. Also today, Al Franken, the apparent victor in the hard-fought Minnesota Senate race, is still facing possible legal challenges from his opponent, incumbent Republican Norm Coleman, so he won't be seated in the new Senate today either. Once the dust settles, though, Democrats will have control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 16 years, with their largest majority in the Senate in three decades. What they face is the most serious set of challenges of any Congress since the Great Depression and the Second World War. With us now is veteran Congress watcher David Hawkins, managing editor for Congressional Quarterly. And welcome, David.
Nice to be with you.
Good to have you. David, let's start with this Roland Burris story, which I guess a bit of a distraction from the big, important work of the country. But it was pretty dramatic today, wasn't it? What happened?
Yeah, it sure was. It was very dramatic. Burris, surrounded by a team of lawyers and an even larger phalanx of reporters, all under great giant golf umbrellas because it's driving rain here, sort of walking up, literally walking up the hill, Capitol Hill, and into the Senate, onto the Senate side of the Capitol, where Mr. Burris attempted to essentially repeat what had happened yesterday, which was presenting his credentials to the Secretary of the Senate. And the Secretary of the Senate rejected those credentials because, she noted, the piece of paper appointing him, while signed by embattled Governor Blagojevich, was not signed by the Secretary of State in Illinois. That Secretary of State says she wouldn't sign it, as a signal that, you know, she doesn't believe it's a valid appointment. But it's in, I don't want to be taking sides here, but it seems pretty straightforward that she's supposed to sign it. It's a ministerial function, not a discretionary function, and that she should have signed it.
Now, early on, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he'd been very clear that he would not seat anyone picked by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. But his tone seems to have softened in the last couple of days. What's next in this story? I mean, is there any way Burris is going to get into the Senate, or what's your take?
It doesn't look like it. I think the slightly cynical but well-supported by the reporting story is that the Senate here in Washington is sort of biding for time, hoping that the Illinois legislature will move quickly in its plans to impeach Blagojevich and remove him from office, and that if that can happen in the next couple of weeks, then the new governor, the lieutenant governor now, Pat Quinn, would become the governor, and he would get to make the appointment, and this whole thing would be made moot, because everybody agrees that Governor Quinn is not tainted and could make an appointment that no one would object to.
I see. Now,
we have, by the way, I should just say, for those of you listening on the radio, we have the historic sight right now of Joe Biden being sworn in by Dick Cheney as a senator. But we'll get to that in a minute.
Well, let's talk about that, because as we all know, Joe Biden is the vice president-elect, and yet he's being sworn in. Talk about that.
Well, he decided he stood for re-election to a seventh term in the Senate last November, even on the same day he was running for vice president, and he won resoundingly. I think he got more than 70% of the vote. And he decided that he did not want to, having been elected seven times, which is a rarity in American history, he wanted to at least come back to the Senate, which has been his only place of employment since about 1972, and take the oath. He's one of only four senators in the modern era who have spent more than half of their life in the Senate, and he, as I say, he's one of them. So it's still a place that he holds in great fondness and reverence, and of course, once he's the vice president, he'll be back to ceremonially preside over the Senate.
I see. Now, Al Franken, on the last vote count, has narrowly defeated incumbent Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman. He's not going to be seated today. Where do we stand with that race in the 10 seconds that we have left?
Well, sure. Where we stand with that is that the courts, that will now go to the courts. Coleman, the Republican incumbent who appears to have lost by 225 votes, says he will challenge these results in court, and it could be several weeks before that's resolved. In the meantime, neither side will attempt to seat their senator. So the Senate unusually will be beginning the new Congress with just 98 senators.
Well, some drama today in what is usually a sort of day of ceremony. Thank you so much, David Hawkins, for your help.
Nice to have been with you.
Okay, that's Congress watcher David Hawkins. He's the managing editor for Congressional Quarterly Weekly. And one of the big pressing questions regarding the historic election of Barack Obama is, of course, will the new president be allowed to use his much relied upon BlackBerry when he moves to the White House? Sounds like a trivial matter, to be sure, but Barack Obama has called his BlackBerry his link to the real world outside the presidential bubble. And he might have to stop using it due to concerns about email security and a law that subjects all presidential correspondence to review. So it's ironic that the man who's been called the first online social networking president might not be able to use the very tools that his campaign and voters seized upon and employed so effectively to win the White House. We're going to hear from Andrew Roche, an expert on the intersection of politics and technology. But first, to Jose Antonio Vargas, who was the first reporter for The Washington Post to focus on internet and politics. He joins us from the newspaper's radio studio. And welcome, Jose.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Good to have you. First of all, what do we really know about Obama and his BlackBerry? Is the most powerful man in the world really going to have to give it up?
That has not been decided yet, as far as I know. What I do find interesting, though, is that the fact of the matter is all these rules, especially kind of the presidential filing rules, need updating. And I think that's something that they're probably looking at right now.
The technology is so new.
The technology is there. I mean, there's no reason why, for example, you know, they have to save every correspondence that the president has, right? There's no reason why they can't save that at a server at the end of the night, you know, when he has to take the BlackBerry off and go to bed. That's something that I think they're probably even looking at right now.
You've probably thought about this. What would the effect be, do you think, if he isn't allowed to use his BlackBerry or if he is allowed to keep it and sort of continues BlackBerrying away?
Well, I actually liked I thought it was interesting what he had to say to Barbara Walters about this idea of he doesn't want to be in a bubble. I mean, the more interesting thing about having a BlackBerry, as people who have BlackBerry knows, is, you know, I'm getting about 20, 25 emails, I don't know, within an hour. And I get that from people from all across the world, from my cousins in the Philippines or from my aunt in San Francisco. And so you just have a bigger pool of people, you know, trying to connect with you. And when you're the president, I mean, you're basically just kind of in this small bubble in which you deal with 8-9 people, and that's it for most of the day. So I think it's interesting that, you know, he wants to reach out. I mean, we're talking about a president here, you know, who has grown up in a very kind of international setting.
Right. Jose, you recently spoke to President Bush's internet director, and he said Clinton was the first web president, Bush is the first digital president, and Obama is the first online social networking president. What did he mean?
Well, a lot of that has to do with the technology. I mean, of course, you know, in the mid-90s, Bill Clinton and Al Gore being, you know, incredibly prescient about the role of the internet in society at large, I mean, decided that the technology was there, and they had to get the White House on the web, which they did. After that, you know, the rise of podcasting, RSS feeds, video was, you know, helped by the Bush administration in the way that they were able to use that on WhiteHouse.gov. We have to put this into context. The rise of Facebook, YouTube, MySpace, social networking in general is a relatively young – I mean, it's basically still a toddler. It's only about 4 or 5 years old, if that. And so I think what we're seeing here is the rise of this new kind of – Andrew Roche is going to speak to this – the rise of this new kind of participatory class of people who want to have a conversation with their government. And I think that's what we're going to see with the Obama administration.
Well, you mentioned Andrew Roche, and he's the other voice that we're going to bring into this conversation. Andrew Roche is founder of the Personal Democracy Forum, which focuses on the intersection of politics and technology. He advised Democrats such as Hillary Clinton, Tom Daschle, and Dick Gephardt, and he joins us now. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, your thoughts on where we are in the evolution of politics and the internet, or on anything else you heard us talk about.
Well, I agree with Jose wholeheartedly that the administration is currently looking at how to reboot their operations of not just the White House and the president's own relationship with the information, but the entire government bureaucracy. It needs to be brought into the 21st century. It's still in some ways stuck in the 19th century, believe it or not. There are some processes that are, you know, just repeated from one administration to another simply because it's been done before that way and no one had the forethought or the or the power of innovation in their mind to think about doing it in a new way. But what the Obama campaign proved to many of the leaders of the political classes, the party leaders, the mainstream media, and those involved in politics, is that the technology has advanced so far that the public now is banging at the door, demanding to participate, much more than just voting, but by connecting with each other and like-minded people around particular issues, and are asking for an opportunity to not only be involved in elections, but in the governing process itself.
Give a specific example or two about that. How would that work? I mean, when you talk about the average person being able to be involved in actually the process of democracy and governing, how would that work?
Well, I mean, it came to me quite clearly when my 82-year-old dad called me up and asked me to help him figure out how to do more than one email address at a time because he was sending Barack Obama YouTube videos to his 50 friends during the campaign, and my dad didn't, you know, before that wouldn't have picked up the phone to call his friends and endorse the candidate, but here he was becoming a 21st century political pamphleteer and reaching 50 friends in one afternoon that it would normally have taken him a year and a half to reach in a traditional social setting where political opinion normally gets formed. And my dad's, you know, obviously not very technically advanced, but there are lots of people out there who are building websites or have skills that are much more technically advanced using all kinds of tools like YouTube, making videos, building blogs, creating social networks on either their own sites or on Facebook and MySpace or other similar sites, and are building consensus amongst themselves. You know, organized minorities are always more powerful than disorganized majorities. And the technology allows for small groups of people to organize themselves to affect change. We actually saw an example of this during the campaign when Barack Obama's own social network site was temporarily hijacked by 20,000 supporters of Barack Obama who were actually protesting his vote on the FISA legislation. And they basically stated to Obama that they would stop campaigning for him or raising money for him because they were so upset at his vote, to the point where he responded to them and then assigned a number of his staff to answer their questions and to quell the insurgency.
Right. This was angry reaction to his vote on government surveillance, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
That was a learning moment for the Obama administration that the public isn't going to sit around idly waiting to be talk to. They want to talk back.
That's Andrew Roche, founder of the Personal Democracy Forum. We've also been speaking with Jose Antonio Vargas, a staff writer for the Washington Post who covers politics and the internet. We'll continue our conversation in a moment, but first a correction. We refer to the Illinois Secretary of State as being a woman. In fact, Jesse White is a man. Our apologies. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. We're talking about how the internet is transforming politics. Signs of that are everywhere. Barack Obama is promising to make his economic recovery plan available on the internet with a Google-like search function to show each proposed project or program by congressional district. And he'll be hosting what aides are calling the first neighborhood inaugural ball with free or low-cost tickets, and those who can't make it can attend online. Joining us now and continuing our conversation is Andrew Roche. He's a technology expert who founded the website Personal Democracy Forum, and Jose Antonio Vargas, who's the first reporter for the Washington Post to cover politics and the internet. And Jose, let me pick up with you. You're in your late 20s. Tell us how you came to this beat. You write about a trip you took to the University of Northern Iowa just before the Iowa caucuses a year ago, and what convinced you that there was something worth reporting?
Frankly, I actually had this analogy comparing official Washington to kind of the encyclopedia era. It's stuck in this encyclopedia era in which only a small group of people are in charge when it comes to, you know, making legislation and getting things passed, getting laws passed. Well, the rest of the country is living in a Wikipedia era. Mm-hmm. At any given moment right now, if you go to Wikipedia, you're going to find the most comprehensive article on Barack Obama. You're not going to find it on the Washington Post or the New York Times. You're going to find it on Wikipedia. Why? Because all of these people, all of these people who care about information, have gone there to edit it and re-edit it and add as much information as they can. Mm. So I think that's an interesting development. Mm.
But what happened to the University of Northern Iowa?
I actually got sent to Iowa for a couple of weeks because I guess at the time I'm the only one who doesn't, you know, who's not married. So they sent me for a couple of weeks in Iowa. And I was proving my thesis that all the online organizing on Facebook and YouTube and MySpace were going to make a difference on the ground, offline. And I found the group of kids on Facebook. I just did a search, Iowa, Barack Obama, and all of these Facebook groups came up. And I specifically chose that group because they were meeting, because I was actually following Barack Obama for a couple of days, and they were meeting at a place near where I was at. So I ended up going there and meeting these kids who had been organizing independent of the campaign, campaigning for Obama and helping canvass supporters. So that was really interesting.
And Andrew Roche, didn't Howard Dean and his campaign manager, Joe Trippi, really start this marriage of internet and politics with this sort of fantastic fundraising machine that they put up?
Well, I think that they tripped over it. You know, I think one of the problems for Howard was that they didn't completely understand what was going on. I mean, the reality of it was that he was running a pretty traditional campaign, running around the country, basically saying George Bush was wrong, and bloggers who heard his message around the country, you know, contacted the campaign staff up in Burlington, Vermont, who were mostly 24 or 25 year old kids, and said, "Hey, we think your boss is cool. Do you mind if we create a blog on his behalf?" And since there were no adults, many adults up at the Burlington office, those kids said, "Sure, go right ahead." And before you know it, there were 300, 400 blogs for Howard Dean, Lesbians for Howard Dean, Punk Rockers for Howard Dean, Peoria, Illinois for Howard Dean. And the result of that community built online, primarily using blogs, generated $22 million of small donations and fundraising online that propelled his campaign. But it wasn't enough. You need more than just blogs and online fundraising to be successful as a candidate. The candidate himself has to have other attributes. The timing has to be right. There's a lot of other factors in politics than just the use of the technology. After Howard Dean managed to at least get everyone to raise an eyebrow that it was possible to raise a lot of money online, the next iteration of the internet's effect on politics was seen with the macaca moment of George Allen uttering a phrase that was captured on YouTube and then distributed.
It went viral, I guess is the expression that we use, right? It went viral and then ended
his campaign for Senate and then most likely his opportunity to become Republican candidate for president as well. And so a lot of people at that time felt that, you know, maybe the internet didn't elect anybody, but it certainly unelected him. Mm-hmm. And we saw the Ned Lamont campaign take out Joe Lieberman as the Democratic nominee in Connecticut. But again, because Ned Lamont didn't win the election, the majority of the political punditry around the country poo-pooed the internet again as saying, well, it didn't elect Ned Lamont, so we don't have to pay attention to it.
Andrew, what's the note of caution or of skepticism that we need to sound here? In other words, you know, this creates an enormous potential. You write about personal democracy, and it empowers people. It gives people access to wonderful sets of information, and you know, we've talked about how it's helped people like Barack Obama become elected. But, you know, what's the note of skepticism about all this technology that we need to be careful of?
Well, we need to be careful. First of all, it's the same as when we were going to school. You know, we were told, don't believe everything you read. It's the same, if not more, has to be applied to the internet. There's lots, you know, everything that's bad in the world and good in the world is represented on the internet. And so we can't assume that everything on the internet is necessarily true or that everyone who is stating things on the internet is doing so for benevolent reasons. So we have to be cautious. Secondly, even though the technology is powerful and allows people to connect to each other, it's not going to reinvent government and reinvent democracy overnight. It's going to take time, and it's only going to take time if people get involved. And we have to fix other pillars of our democracy that have been neglected and broken long before we even talk about technology, such as public education, because you cannot have a successful democracy unless you have an educated public. So there's a process that the whole country has to go through in getting itself to understand how to take advantage of information networks when it makes sense for the public to be involved. New leaders need to rise through these technologies to lead and we need to come up with new ways of solving problems, and some of those may be unrelated to the typical governing processes of electing congressmen and senators to write legislation, but actually people banding together and figuring out how to solve problems themselves without even having the government involved.
Hmm. Andrew Ruscha, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
That's Andrew Ruscha. He's founder of the Personal Democracy Forum. We also heard from Jose Antonio Vargas, a staff writer for The Washington Post who covers politics and the Internet. Tomorrow on Here and Now, while universities are cutting spending and freezing new hires, we'll hear from a college dean who, despite the recession, is on a faculty hiring binge. That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, the story of a house cleaner on Nantucket off the coast of Massachusetts who lost her life savings to a longtime associate of Bernard Madoff. It's Here and Now. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Everybody knows how important a seeing-eye dog is to a blind person. So for good reason, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the so-called ADA, protects the rights of disabled people to take their service animals into public spaces, stores, and businesses. But the strict definition of a service animal is murky, and the issue becomes confusing and controversial when some people claim their horses, monkeys, parrots, even their ferrets are covered by the ADA. In response to a growing chorus of complaints and lawsuits about this increasingly exotic menagerie of service animals, the Department of Justice, which oversees the ADA, is proposing new regulations. Joining us from Memphis is Rebecca Skloot, whose story on this appeared in the New York Times Sunday magazine. And welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you.
First of all, give us an idea of some of the more exotic service animals you came across. Your piece begins with a story about a seeing-eye miniature horse.
Yes. And in some ways, she's sort of the least exotic of the animals because people are, you know, at least used to seeing horses places, maybe not in restaurants. But the more exotic of them is definitely the monkeys. There are quite a few service monkeys. Some have been trained to help quadriplegics with, you know, everything from opening bottles and, you know, picking up phones to putting food in the microwave. They've been doing that since the early 80s. And now there's a woman who uses a service monkey for her agoraphobia.
There's yeah, this is a parrots. Woman you write about. She suffers from agoraphobia and panic attacks, and she claims that her monkey actually calms her down, right?
Yeah, he. When she begins to have a panic attack, he actually recognizes it before she does, and he will climb up, you know, sort of under her shoulder, and he'll stroke her hair, and he'll play with her ears, and he'll just sort of snap her out of it. Hmm. And there's also parrots. There's a parrot that is used to essentially talk a bipolar man down from having psychotic episodes. When he starts to get very upset, the bird will say, "It's okay, Jim. Calm down, Jim. You're all right, Jim."
And he carries this parrot around in a sort of retrofitted backpack, right, that allows the parrot to sort of go with him wherever he goes.
That's right. He basically doesn't leave home without the parrot, and he's run into trouble in terms of not being able to bring his parrot into places. He's actually involved in a case right now where he tried to get his teeth cleaned at a local dental school, and they said, "We don't allow parrots." And he said, "It's my service animal." And they said, "Sorry, parrots can't be service animals," which, according to the ADA, you can't really say that because there is no species definition in the ADA.
Well, what does the ADA actually say about what constitutes a legitimate service animal?
Right now what it says is any guide dog, signal dog, or other animal individually trained to do work or perform a task for the benefit of someone with a disability is a service animal. So the key words there are individually trained and work or task. That's really how they define an animal, but they very clearly say or other animal. And I talked to one of the actual architects of the original ADA, and he said that while they were drafting that language, they were very specific about not wanting to ban monkeys, miniature horses, and any other animal that might actually help someone.
Rebecca, I gather that one of the concerns about these various service animals have to do with public health concerns, correct?
Yeah. It's often cited as the reason why these animals shouldn't be allowed places. But I talked to a lot of public health experts about this, and every one of them that I talked to said miniature horses, ferrets, parrots, any of these unusual species pose no more of a health risk than dogs and cats.
And what about monkeys, though?
Yeah, I was going to say monkeys are a slightly different story because some strains of monkeys can carry viruses that are deadly to humans, and they can often show little to no symptoms in the monkeys. Herpes B is one of them. But nobody really knows how much of a risk service monkeys would actually pose in that department. There have been no cases of service monkeys transmitting viruses. There have been no cases of pet monkeys, really. So there's definitely some legitimate public health questions about what monkeys you should use, where those monkeys should come from, how they should be screened, and all of that. But it definitely doesn't seem to apply as broadly to the monkeys as people maybe believe.
And so the Department of Justice wants to revise these rules or propose new regulations, I guess. What is it proposing to do or considering doing?
What they've proposed is limiting service animal to a dog or other commonly domesticated animal. And they've specifically excluded wild animals, including, you know, monkeys, reptiles, rabbits, farm animals, including any strain of horse, including miniature horses. They even list amphibians, goats, ferrets, rodents. So they've gotten very specific to the point where it seems like the only things that could really fit are dogs and cats and, ironically, fish.
Fish.
Yeah, though, you know, I'm not sure how many people will be carrying their fish around. And there are actually quite a few people who can't use service dogs because they're allergic to them. Mm. There are some people who prefer the miniature horses for guide animals because they can live and work for up to 30 years, where a guide dog is more like 6 to 8 years mm-hmm. that they work. And there's a whole list of things that the miniature horses can do that dogs can't. Same with monkeys. So the advocates are sort of saying that this is very short-sighted. The actual sort of opponents are largely businesses who are saying, whoa, wait a minute, you know, my restaurant is not equipped for a miniature horse, or, you know, do I really have to let this, you know, duck on the bus? And then surprisingly, one of the more outspoken groups has been the service dog users, because people often see, you know, the miniature horses and the ferrets and the monkeys, and they think the person's faking it. This is just a weird person, and they don't have a legitimate service animal. And so the service dog users are saying, yeah, this is going to cause problems for us. And ironically, the majority of cases of fraud, of which there are many, are people saying that they need their dogs. People who just want to take their dog with them to a restaurant or on, you know, on an airplane or wherever. And so they say, oh, yeah, it's a service dog. And because of the way the ADA is written, businesses can't challenge people very much on that. So if someone walks in with a service animal, business owner can say, what task does that animal do for you? What they can't say is, what's wrong with you? How does it help you? That's actually a violation of the law because it probes into their medical history. If they do end up questioning someone and saying, I don't think your animal's legitimate, if they're wrong, they'll end up very likely in a lawsuit. It's also hard to tell. You know, there's also this very fuzzy line with people who have anxiety disorder where, you know, their animal might calm them down and prevent them from having anxiety attacks. But if that animal isn't specifically trained to do something that's related to the disability, it actually doesn't qualify as a service animal. And a lot of people don't know that. So they'll say, you know, this is my anxiety ferret and it's a service animal. But in fact, if it's not trained to do something legally, it probably doesn't qualify.
I see. Rebecca, when are these regulation changes going to take effect?
We don't really know. The Department of Justice held some hearings over the summer where they let people come and give public testimony sort of for or against the changes. So a lot of people showed up with their service monkeys and various things and sort of made their arguments. And no one knows how the DOJ sort of responded to that. They have approved their new regulations. They did that on December 3rd, and then they sent it to the Office of Management and Budget, which will have to approve it to actually have it instituted. It could be tomorrow. It could be a few months from now. They won't actually comment on that.
Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for talking to us about this. Fascinating story.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Rebecca Skloot. She spoke to us from Memphis. Her story on service animals and the Americans with Disabilities Act appeared in the latest edition of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And still to come today, 3 years and counting, a new film looks at the painfully slow process of rebuilding New Orleans. You're listening to Here and Now. When you read about the colossal financial scandal involving Bernard Madoff, the dateline usually comes from places like New York, Miami Beach, Paris, and London. And the victims of his $50 billion Ponzi scheme are usually the rich and sometimes the famous. But the Madoff scandal has long tentacles, which also touch places like the tiny island of Nantucket off the coast of Massachusetts and the not-so-rich, people like Bulgarian housekeeper named Navina Ivanova. She gave her life savings, $124,000, to Frank Avellino, a well-known summer resident of Nantucket. Avellino had long ties to Madoff, and now he is accused of cheating Ivanova, whose money is assumed to have disappeared in the collapse of Madoff's financial scheme. Joining us is Jason Grazia-Day. He's the senior writer for Nantucket's weekly newspaper, The Enquirer and Mirror. And Jason, what's the story here? How did this housekeeper, Navina Ivanova, hand over and then lose her life savings to Frank Avellino?
This case came to light in Nantucket District Court just before the new year. And basically what's outlined in the complaint is that Ms. Ivanova was befriended by Frank Avellino and his wife, Nancy, when she was hired as the house cleaner for his Cliff Road estate on Nantucket. And she entrusted Frank Avellino and his wife with her life savings, $124,000, which she understood was going to be invested with high return, high percentage returns. And this past year in July, she wanted to take some of her money out to put her daughter through college and also possibly buy a house. And then on December 1st, she asked him, well, I want to take my money out now. And he said, I'm sorry, it's entirely lost.
It's entirely lost because he allegedly invested it in Bernard Madoff's fund, right?
Well, that's what's implied. It doesn't specifically say where the money was invested, if it was with Bernard Madoff. But we do know that Frank Avellino has substantial ties to Bernard Madoff going back to the 60s. He was actually sued by the SEC back in 1992 for running an illegal investment company in which he managed to secure $441 million from thousands of investors, and he handed this over to Bernard Madoff Investment Securities. And an interesting thing, according to the complaint, it says that Avellino told Ms. Ivanova that her money was gone on December 1st. Now, Madoff wasn't charged until later in December. So if that money was invested with Madoff, it sort of implicates Avellino as knowing what was going to happen with Madoff before he was actually charged and before it actually came out in the news.
And what has Frank Avellino said about this? Has he spoken publicly and responded to these charges?
No, he's not spoken publicly. We've not heard from him, and he actually has not even named a defense attorney in the case in Nantucket District Court yet. Mr. Avellino is fairly well-known on the island. He's given lots of money to the Nantucket Athenaeum, the island's library, the Nantucket Preservation Trust, the Island Shakespeare Festival. So he's been involved in philanthropy here on the island, and I think a lot of people were surprised. It did kind of come as a shock.
And what about Navina Ivanova, the house cleaner? Is there any effort being made for her to recoup her money?
Well, right now what her attorney, Michael Wilson, has done is successfully petitioned the judge in Nantucket District Court to impose a lien, a real estate attachment on Avellino's home on Cliff Road for $124,000, the amount that she claims she lost.
Might that set a precedent for how to resolve some of these cases?
That might be one way that you see these people who have been swindled for their money go after either Madoff or his associates who funneled money to him. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this type of action in courts, not only in New York, but other places such as Florida, where the scandal has really hit hard.
And besides the story of this housekeeper losing her life savings, has there been any other Madoff fallout on the island of Nantucket?
We are following several leads now and looking into the any other connections, because when we first heard about the Bernard Madoff story, we assumed with so much wealth out here that there had to be some connections tying this. And we assume that we're probably going to be seeing some more lawsuits filed similar to the one as Ms. Ivanova.
Hmm. Well, Jason Grazia-Day, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Jason Grazia-Day is the senior writer for Nantucket's weekly newspaper, The Enquirer and Mirror. Coming up in just a minute, the determination of an 82-year-old man to rebuild his home after Hurricane Katrina, here and now. Although it's been more than 3 years since Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast and devastated New Orleans, much of the city remains ruined. Now, a new public television frontline documentary examines the painfully slow process of rebuilding New Orleans through the eyes of 82-year-old Herbert Gettridge, a longtime resident of the predominantly black Lower Ninth Ward. At the beginning of the film, we see Gettridge in January of 2006, determined to restore his home that he and his 84-year-old wife, Lydia, had lived in for decades.
I'm going to be here till they pull me out of here. I ain't about to leave. It took me too long, and I worked too hard to build what I had here to just pick up and leave like that. I ain't about to leave.
Despite that resolve, over the next year and a half, Gettridge's determination is sorely tested by bureaucratic red tape, a lack of funds, and a lack of help. The documentary is called The Old Man and the Storm, and filmmaker June Cross joins us from the Argo Network Studios in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you, Anthony.
Good to have you. We're also joined from New Orleans by Gail Gettridge Brannon. She's one of Herbert Gettridge's 9 children. And welcome to you, Gail. Good to have you.
Thank you.
June, let me start with you and talk about what drew you to Herbert Gettridge's story. One thing that stood out in the movie, as we first see him, he's virtually alone in the Lower Ninth Ward rebuilding his house. What drew you to him?
The fact that he was alone in the Lower Ninth Ward rebuilding his house. I had gone down there wondering what was going to determine who was going to be able to come back. And I had talked to several people and even talked to some more even after I met Mr. Gettridge. But he was there. He was a constant. He was sort of like my North Star. I could go back there and he was always there, always working.
And Gail, tell me something about your father. I mean, a very determined soul, clearly.
Yes, he was very determined, and he still is. Ever since I've known him, he's been a person who never waited on anyone. Whatever he had to do, he put his mind to do it and just got busy doing it. And of course, that's what he proved that he was going to do after Katrina, and he did it.
And Gail, can you talk about the effect the storm had on your family? And this is a piece that comes across very clearly in June's film. You have a big family, large extended family. You all lived within 5 and 10 minutes of each other. And now, where are you all?
We're scattered from Dallas, Plano, Irving, Texas, Houston, Austin, to Utah, to Oklahoma, to Atlanta. Kids had to go where the jobs were, and of course, the infrastructure here in New Orleans, as far as the hospitals, grocery stores, banks, it's not the same.
Sure. June, it's not the same indeed. I mean, one of the things that struck me, I was down there in February of 2006, and even though I had seen the images, like most Americans, on TV, there was no way to prepare for the kind of damage that ensued. I mean, block after block after block after block. Did it surprise you when you actually got down there and saw it with your own eyes and your own camera?
Oh, my God, yeah. I had a tape that just had about 10 minutes of footage that I hadn't turned the camera off where I was rolling around, and there was nothing to be seen but devastation. It was like if on a September 11th, the entire island of Manhattan had been destroyed and the World Trade Center had stood. That was sort of the analogy.
Well, fairly late in the film, Herbert Gettridge voices his frustration at the amount of time that's passed and how little has been accomplished in his neighborhood. And I just want to play that clip and then talk about it.
2 years and we're still not back in shape. 2 years, some people's been away from here exactly 2 years in August. They've been away from their home. Homes torn down, automobiles lost. Few pennies they may have had that went down in the drain. Yeah, pretty soon there'll be nobody but me and the weeds back here.
Nobody but me and the weeds back here, he says. June, can you talk about some of the reasons it's taking so long? I mean, one of the symbols, one of the images, central images of your film is Herbert Gettridge gets his house rebuilt, but it sort of stands alone.
First of all, the insurance companies didn't pay off because people were had homes that were underinsured, and meaning that they weren't insured for the full value of the house. They were insured for the mortgage value of the house. Then the state had this road home program, which it got through federal money, which the bureaucracy that they came up with was incredibly Byzantine. At one point, I was talking to one of the chief executives for the Road Home program, and he said, there are two people who understand how this program works, and we're not sure. Then there was just a huge amount of federal wrangling going back and forth between Baton Rouge and Washington over exactly how much money was going to be spent and how many homes had in fact been impacted. It's just been one bureaucratic hassle after the other, and really a lack of political will in Washington to sort of say, make this right now, you know?
Yeah. And is there a sense, and maybe this is a question for Gail, do you feel that much of the country has sort of forgotten about New Orleans?
There's an old saying, a city that care forgot. Yes, much of the country has forgotten about New Orleans. New Orleans itself is a tale of two cities. It's the uptown section, the ritzy rich, that did not get flooded. They're flourishing. The lakefront, folks who know how to maneuver the system that got the money to put their houses back, it's coming back strong. And then there's the Lower Ninth Ward, and we were the most devastated area, yet and still we're the last to come back. The federal government failed us.
Hmm.
The federal government should have stepped in, and it didn't. It just sort of abdicated. And it's hard to come to any other conclusion than that it was about poor black people and wanting to get rid of poor black people in that city.
We hear at the beginning, as we played, Herbert Gettridge expressing how bound and determined he is to rebuild his home. By the end, you ask him whether or not it was all worth it. And this is what he says in response.
I'm kind of skeptical about that now. Once upon a time, I could answer that question in a split second for you. I can't do that now.
Gail, tell me how that makes you feel. I mean, do you feel that it was worth it, that you're father making that effort and rebuilding that house?
It was worth it because of his actions, because of his stand. It gave others the courage to come back and do what they needed to do. I can understand why he's saying that, though. If you're living here and you have to drive so far to get to a hospital or for medical care, we don't have a grocery store or a supermarket within 5 or 10 miles of where we live. Those are the things that make it questionable. And then to compound the fact that you don't have your grandkids around you. And it's not just with the Gettridge family, it's with many families. Not just poor, but working class, college educated, who decided to come back to the Lower Ninth Ward. This is what we're going through.
And June, what was your sort of final thought when you heard Herbert Gettridge say, I'm not so sure I can tell you for sure that it was worth it?
I had heard that so many times from so many, not just, as Gail said, not just from Gettridge's, but from others who had chosen to go back to the most devastated areas. No political statement, no statement had been made about, are we going to bring this back or not? And it's just sort of been left to, it's almost like Wild Wild West. If you go out there and do it, maybe we'll do something for you. But it's a very cavalier attitude. We've stripped the ladder away from a whole group of folks who were able to get children into college or able to get grandkids into the professions, and it's criminal.
Hmm. We've been speaking with filmmaker June Cross. Her Frontline special, The Old Man and the Storm, airs tonight on PBS stations across the country. We also heard from Gail Gettridge Brannon. Her father, Herbert Gettridge, is featured in the film. She joined us from New Orleans. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information on The Old Man and the Storm, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow, Here and Now.